about DNA and chromatin structure. We went over the basics last time, but today I want to consider the question of the implications of all that structure business. So last time we talked about the structure of nucleosomes, the idea that DNA is wound around cores of nucleosomes, and then the nucleosomes are in turn folded upon each other to make various degrees of compaction. And we said that if you fold the DNA up very, very tight, more properly the chromatin up very, very tight, you get heterochromatin, which is the way all... You don't really need the top of 10A, of 9 from yesterday. It's nice if you have it, but you don't really need it. But you are going to need 10. That if you fold up the chromatin very, very tightly, you get heterochromatin. That's the way all chromatin is during mitosis, meiosis. And some chromatin remains that way throughout interphase. And that DNA is genetically inactive. It is not transcribed. However, most of the chromatin in a cell during interphase loosens up considerably and is said to be euchromatic or euchromatin. And we said that there's probably a continuum, but for convenience, we divided euchromatin into loose, looser, and loosest, meaning the packing of the nucleosomes. And we said that there is a correlation between the looseness of the euchromatin and the genetic activity. Now, what I want to talk about today is how we know that. How do we know that more active chromatin is actually looser? If you look at euchromatin under most conditions, it looks pretty much the same. The differences here are subtle, especially between loose and looser. They really don't look that different. Certainly in the light microscope, you can't tell the difference. So what you would really like to know is, consider a particular gene, say the gene for globin. That's the protein part of hemoglobin. You would like to fish that gene out of a cell that is making hemoglobin, or more properly, fish the chromatin with that gene out of a cell that's making globin, and fish the chromatin with that gene out of a cell that isn't. And then you want to ask, what state is the DNA and the chromatin in? Is it tight in one and loose in the other? Because you would expect that in a cell that's not making globin, the globin region is tight, and a cell that's making globin, the globin region is loose. Well, unfortunately, you can't do that directly. There is no way to do that. What you have to do is you have to do the experiment in reverse. What you have to do is treat the DNA or fractionate the DNA to distinguish loose from tight. And then you say, what's with my globin gene? If I get my globin gene out of the loose, what's it like? Is it loose? Is it still okay? Now, to make this clearer, you want to look at handout 10B. Is really about how do you figure out if a particular gene is in tight chromatin or loose chromatin. And you do that largely by treating the chromatin with DNAs. Now, there are a whole bunch of different DNAs. All of them cut DNA at random with respect to sequence. And they differ in their properties. Micrococcal nuclease, we talked about last time, seems to prefer a region in the linker of nucleosomes and gives you those ladder patterns. DNase 1 seems to prefer exposed DNA. So if the DNA is tightly wound on nucleosomes and or the nucleosomes are packed on each other, DNase 1 doesn't degrade. But if things are loose, DNase 1 can get in and chew up. So sensitivity to DNase 1 has been used to tell loose chromatin from looser, from tight, etc. Now, the easiest way to explain this is to think for a minute. What if we started with some plain old DNA? Not chromatin, just DNA. And we cut it up with a restriction enzyme. In fact, if you look at your flow chart here, what we're saying is skip step one. Start not with chromatin, but with DNA. In fact, skip 2A. So one is treating with DNAs. Two is removing protein. So we didn't treat with DNAs, and we removed the protein, and we just have plain old DNA. Now, if we take that DNA and we cut it with a restriction enzyme, that's 2B, and then we blot it on a gel, we do run a gel and blot it, and then hybridize to a probe. In other words, we do a Southern. You cut the DNA up into manageable pieces, separate the pieces on a gel, and then you hybridize to a probe for your gene. Now, if you do this right, what will you see? You've cut the DNA into pieces. If you were lucky, one of those pieces contains your gene. So when you add the radioactive probe, it will stick to one piece. And you will have one radioactive band. Now, you might have a few radioactive bands depending on how where the restriction enzyme cut and where the probe goes. Now, this is a standard Southern blot. If you don't remember how to do these or you never learned, you should go look them up because these come up a lot. This is a standard procedure. So if you just take plain old DNA, you do this procedure, you get bands. Now, what if you took the DNA and you treated it with DNase 1? And then you did the same thing. Treat the DNA with DNase 1. What will that do? Chop, 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 chop. You will degrade the DNA. Then you cut it up with restriction enzymes. Well, it's already in pieces. You make it into smaller pieces. Then you run it on a gel. Depending on how the small pieces are, you get either no bands at all, or you get sort of a mess of all size little pieces. So when you add your probe, what is it going to stick to? Probably nothing. You'll either get no bands, or you get a lot of smaller pieces, and you get a smear that it sticks to. In the simplest case, you get no bands. So these are sort of the two control situations. Plain old DNA and completely degraded DNA. Now, come back to our experiment, to our issue. What if instead of starting with DNA, you start with chromatin? Now that's what's drawn here where it says euchromatin and a bunch of arrows. If you start with euchromatin, then either it's a relatively tight section or a relatively loose section. And now you do step one, which is to treat with DNAs. So what's going to happen? Now, I didn't fill it in, but you can probably fill it in. If the DNA, if the chromatin is tight, what happens to your DNA? Does it get degraded? No, the DNA is protected. But if your chromatin was loose, what happens to your DNA? Then your gene gets degraded. If your gene is in loose, if the gene you're interested in is in loose euchromatin, it gets degraded. If it's in tight, it gets protected. Then what you do is you remove the DNA, you remove the protein, that's the next step. And I've used these numbers because the picture below is from Becker, and they lump what I've called 2A and 2B together. That's their 2, and their 1 matches my 1. So now what you do is you remove the protein. So either your DNA, what does your DNA and your gene look like? The DNA containing your gene. Either it's degraded, it's in small pieces, or it's completely intact, unhurt. Now what happens if you cut with a restriction enzyme? In fact, all the rest of it is just doing a Southern. You cut with a restriction enzyme, you run a gel, you blot it to paper or nylon, and then you hybridize to a probe. That's steps 2B, and then 3A and 3B. So you do a Southern. So what is it going to look like? So if you take intact DNA, it's exactly like the thing on the top. You have intact DNA. It was protected from DNAs. You cut that DNA up, you run it on a gel, you're going to have sharp bands that hybridize to the probe for your gene. But what if your gene was in loose chromatin? Then your DNA was degraded. So it's in fact like the second case. What's going to happen is that your DNA is degraded so that the small pieces, you cut it up even smaller, you separate the pieces, and in fact, if the pieces are small enough, they just run off the gel, and you have nothing left to hybridize to the probe. So the bottom panel here, taken from Becker, shows the results of an actual experiment. Now, the only thing different about the experiment is that they started with either DNA chromatin from erythrocytes, that's red blood cells. Now, how do you get chromatin from red blood cells? Could you get it from yours? Your red blood cells don't have any DNA. But chicken red blood cells have chromatin. They still have DNA. So if you read the fine print, these are chicken red blood cells. Or they start with chromatin from chicken oviduct. Now, these two tissues are making different proteins. The red blood cells are making globin, and the oviduct is making ovalbumin, which is one of the proteins that is a major part of the egg. So these are making globin. So what they've done here is to take the chromatin, treat it with DNAs, take off the protein so you have plain old DNA, cut it up with a restriction enzyme, and run a Southern. And then you look at the DNA that is left. Now, if you look at the top picture, what's the difference here? This is DNA that has, you often write it this way, no DNAs at this end, a little more DNAs, a little more. So you have four samples here. And the only difference is how much DNAs you added at this stage. Now they have two different probes. They have one to ovalbumin and one to globin. So that means if there's DNA in here from the ovalbumin gene, the probe will stick to it. If there's DNA here from the globin gene, the probe will stick to it. So you take chromatin, no DNAs, get the DNA, cut up the DNA, and then you add the probe to ovalbumin. Well, the DNA is fine. Same thing for globin. But now if you go back and you do it again and you add DNAs, what happens? You notice that no matter how much DNA you add in this range, the ovalbumin gene always is present at the end of your experiment. There is DNA there that your probe hybridizes to. So the ovalbumin gene was not degraded. It was protected at all these concentrations of DNAs. Now, what does that mean? Was this gene in tight chromatin or loose chromatin? It was protected, so it was in tight chromatin. Is that what we expect? That came from cells that were not making ovalbumin. So that implies that the gene that was off was in tight chromatin, and we couldn't get at it with our enzyme. On the other hand, what happened to the globin gene? As you add more and more DNAs, the globin gene is degraded. And if you added enough DNAs, you can't detect DNA at all that hybridizes to the globin gene. So what happened to the DNA from the globin gene? It was degraded. And if it was degraded, what does that mean? Which kind of chromatin was it in? It must have been in loose chromatin. So in those cells, the globin gene was in relatively loose chromatin. So you can add at a certain level of DNAs, namely this one, you can completely degrade the DNA that codes for globin, but you can't degrade the DNA that codes for albumin. So that implies that in these cells, the globin gene is in a loose chromatin, and the ovalbumin gene is in tight. And it's reversed in the oviduct cells. Now, there are a lot of pieces in this experiment, so you want to go back and go over it again and be sure you understand it. And there are a bunch of problems in the problem set that require the same sort of reasoning. Now, using these types of experiments, what do we figure out? Well, maybe the most important thing is that some DNA, some chromatin is much more sensitive to DNAs than others, but all of this DNA is in nucleosomes. Now, another way of looking at it is any of the DNA naked without any protein? And the answer is no. All the DNA is more protected than naked DNA. So there is no naked DNA. But this DNA is actually more sensitive. The DNA in this kind of chromatin is more sensitive than any place else. Therefore, this is the loosest. And this turns out to correspond largely to untranscribed regulatory regions. Now, this DNA has protein, but either the histones have been replaced by transcription factors and regulatory proteins. So you have regulatory proteins or very loose histones, very loose nucleosomes. The recent evidence is that some of these still have nucleosomes, but the nucleosomes are so loosened up that they don't protect the DNA very well. So these appear to be regulatory regions in which the nucleosomes are loose and missing. But all the other things have nucleosomes. Okay. However, these two categories are distinguishable. Transcribed regions that are actually being transcribed, or just were, and abibable, so to speak, but they're not being transcribed this minute. So these are actually being transcribed, and these are not, at least not at the moment. Now, what is surprising about this? We understand that in order to transcribe the DNA, you have to sort of stretch it out. But you would think that if you were actually transcribing DNA, what would you do with the histones? You would just strip them all off. You would get rid of all the nucleosomes, and then RNA polymerase would go down the gene, and when you were all done, you would put the nucleosomes back. This does not appear to be the case. What appears to be the case is if you're not transcribing it, all the nucleosomes are there. If you're transcribing it, still almost all the nucleosomes are there. Only one or two nucleosomes are displaced at a time as RNA polymerase moves through. You have to take apart or loosen one or two nucleosomes, but that's it. All the other nucleosomes remain intact. The argument probably is that loose DNA is just too damageable and too unmanageable and too long. So DNA is in nucleosomes almost all of the time, except for when DNA or RNA polymerase is right there. Now, these sections here are often referred to as hypersensitive sites because very small amounts of DNase 1 will degrade the DNA in these sections and not in the others. Now, in different tissues, different parts of the DNA are in this state. And of course, different parts of the DNA are in this state also. So depending, those things that are being transcribed or regulating what is being transcribed are looser in certain tissues. And in tissues where those genes are not on, those sections are tighter. Now, your notes imply that these regions have no nucleosomes at all. And the older data implied that. The newer data says that some of them do have some nucleosomes. They have other proteins too. But they may have some nucleosomes left, but if they do, those nucleosomes are very loosened up. Now, having said all of this then, what are the implications of the fact that DNA is in nucleosomes? Or, in other words, the DNA in eukaryotes is in euchromatin. It means that to turn the DNA on, you have to somehow open it up enough to be able to read it. But before we discuss how to do that, what questions are there about this stuff? Yeah.
When you say something is relatively loose with euchromatin, does that mean it's looser or loosest?
Okay. His question is, what does loose, loose, or loosest mean? To which the answer is, we're just using it in the English sense. These are not technical definitions, and different people use these terms differently. But probably, just to repeat one more time, there's a continuum from here, loose to loosest, and maybe even from loose to heterochromatic. But we're making these definitions just to make it clear that transcribed DNA chromatin is looser than that which is not transcribed. And the regulatory regions that control what is transcribed appear to be looser yet. Other questions? Okay. So now let's consider the question of how do you turn a eukaryotic gene on? You may remember we said last time that RNA polymerase does not stick to the DNA directly. Transcription factors have to get there first. So if you have chromatin, which is sort of folded up, you're going to have to somehow stretch it out a bit and maybe move or loosen some nucleosomes so you can add the transcription factors and then add the polymerase. So how do you loosen up nucleosomes so you can move them around? We said at the end of class last time that when you look closely at a nucleosome, remember you have nucleosome cores of the 8 histones, 2 each of H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. And then you have DNA wound around it twice, linker and DNA wound around it twice, and a linker, etc. And then you have the histone H1 somewhere out here, or overlapping the linker. Now, we said that when you look at the actual protein structure of the histone octamer, you realize that there are peptide chains that stick out, which are referred to as tails. And this is shown clearly in your books and in on 9B, actually. Now, The point we mentioned last time is that the side chains of the amino acids in the tails can be modified. And these modifications correlate with the tightening and the loosening of the nucleosomes. So it looks like these modifications are enormously important in tightening and loosening up the chromatin. Now, the modification enzymes are multiple, but three of the modifications that are mentioned in your notes are phosphorylation, acetylation, and methylation. So there are enzymes that add phosphates and enzymes that remove phosphates. There are enzymes that add acetyl groups and enzymes that take them off. And these are all added to the side chains of the amino acids in the tails. Now, there are also enzymes that add methyls and take them off. Now, DNA itself can be methylated, but what we're talking about here is not the DNA, but the histones. How do you modify the histones? Now, there are others as well. We think that, you may remember we said last time, that in order to carry out mitosis, you have to disassemble the nuclear membrane. And so the lamins are phosphorylated and come apart into smaller pieces so you can take the nuclear membrane, the nuclear envelope, apart. So what that means is that when you go from G2 to M, kinases become active, and when you go back to interphase, the kinases become inactive, and the phosphatases become active. So that means, with respect to lamins, you put phosphate on when you go into mitosis, and you take phosphate off when you leave. Now, these enzymes have many targets, not just lamins. And one of their targets is histones. So which way should it go? If histones must be phosphorylated when you go into mitosis and dephosphorylated when you come out, so which state of the histones corresponds to tight? What is tight nucleosomes or tight chromatin? Is it plus phosphate or minus phosphate? So think about that one for a minute. Then we'll take a vote. Did you have a question?
Oh, no.
No, you were just talking about it. Okay. Okay. Let's take a vote here. When you phosphorylate a histone, how many people think the nucleosomes get looser? Some? Tighter. The majority is tighter. So let's try the tighter explanation and see if it convinces the looser people. Who's going to defend tighter for me? You aren't very brave this morning. Okay. So what's the rationale here? What happens to chromatin during mitosis? Does it get tighter or looser? It has to get tighter, because remember, you have to fold everything up to make visible chromosomes instead of stretched out chromatin. So at mitosis, you would expect things to get tighter. And since we know they're phosphorylated at meiosis, it makes sense that this is the tighter conformation. Okay, and if you still think it might be looser, you should ask me afterwards. Okay, now it turns out acetylation is the other way around, that adding adding acetyl groups or phosphate acetyl methyl actually loosens loosens the chromatin and is associated with active transcribed chromatin. While phosphorylation tightens it up and is associated with inactive. Now, with methyl groups, it depends. It depends which amino acids in which position on the protein are methylated. Some methylations are associated with loosening and turning on the gene, and some methylations are associated with tightening and turning off. So there's no rule for that. It depends. By contrast, when you methylate DNA itself, usually you turn off the DNA. Not always, but usually. So if you methylate DNA, not the histones, this one is the histone, usually you turn it off. Now that reminds me that in today's science times, there is a long, interesting article about states of chromatin turning genes on and off and how this so-called epigenetic change is inherited. And it's certainly worth taking a look at. Probably we won't give it out until later when Dr. Heiklin talks about development. She'll probably either give it out or refer to it. But you can get it online without any trouble. There's also a link in today's lecture to an article in the Sunday Times Magazine about medicine that those of you who are pre-med might find interesting. All right. Now, in Sadava, in addition to talking about these modification enzymes, they also talk about what they call remodeling proteins. But it seems, after discussing this with an expert, that probably the remodeling proteins are not a separate category, but in fact are the proteins that trigger these modifications. And I will, I'm going to go through the notes and modify it after class with a note about what I think it means. If I modify anything after class, I always mark it in blue so you know what the changes are. You can take a quick look and you don't have to print the whole thing all over again. Now, what we've said here is that to turn a gene on, you have to loosen it up so the transcription factors can get in. And the question has been going for a long time, who comes first? There are two possible solutions here. One is that you have tight chromatin. Now, I shouldn't say tight. I should probably say, we'll say relatively tight, meaning loose as opposed to looser or loosest. And you want to open this up so you can transcribe the gene. Well, one possibility is the transcription factors come first. And they themselves are modification enzymes, or they activate the modification enzymes, and we loosen things up. The other possibility is that the modification enzymes come first, and they open the DNA up, and now the transcription factors can sit down, and now we're loose, and we can turn it on. I should say looser. Now, the question is, who comes first? And the current model is that, in fact, this one is right. But, in a way, the model's a hybrid. Because, remember, there are two types of transcription factors. Those that are called basal, which every gene needs in order to bind RNA polymerase. And those that are called regulatory, that are involved in changing the rate of transcription by the basal regulatory, by the basal transcription factors. We now think that what happens is the regulatory transcription factors really come first. So if you're going to turn a gene on, a regulatory transcription factor binds to and opens up the DNA a little by activating the modification enzymes. By activating the modification enzymes, You then change the state of the nucleosomes, loosen the chromatin, so then the basal transcription factors come along with RNA polymerase. So we have to call these regulatory. So the current model is that the regulatory transcription factors trigger modifications. The modifications change the state of the chromatin, and that allows transcription. Now, what Sadava calls remodeling factors are probably these regulatory transcription factors, which trigger the modification, which trigger the changes in actual transcription and gene expression. So when we talk about loose, looser, and loosest, the relatively tight chromatin is loose. Generally, if it's heterochromatic, it's so tight that you can forget about it during interphase. But if it's loose, you can bind regulatory transcription factors, and they bind to the region that becomes loosest. And that causes the whole area to become looser. And looser is because of the modifications, and that's where this is also the basal transcription factors bind to the loosest part. So what we're really saying here, and it may be clearer than the loose, looser, loosest business, is that transcription factors, both regulatory ones and basal ones, bind to regulatory regions, not to the part that's transcribed. And that part is the most exposed. So what we really want to look at is if you had some DNA and you were going to transcribe it, what features of the DNA and the transcription factors do you have to take into account? So what I want to talk about now are the details of actual transcription. But before I do that, are there any questions? So now what we want to look at is 10A. Now, a point that we made last time was that whatever goes on in eukaryotes is similar to what goes on in prokaryotes, except it's always more complicated. There's always more parts and more interactions. So to carry out eukaryotic transcription, of course you need RNA polymerase, but as we said last time, there are multiple polymerases. You also need a lot of proteins, all these transcription factors, not to mention modification enzymes. You need to have a lot of enzymes to get the chromatin in the right shape so you can transcribe it. Now, if you're going to have a lot of transcription factors, both basal and regulatory, they're going to have to stick to the DNA somewhere. And so you're going to have a lot of regulatory sites. Now, one way to explain this is that every time you have a transcription factor, you have a section of DNA on which it sits. And the two together make up a switch. And you have to have both parts in order to get any action. But the two parts are distinguished. And people talk about cis-acting regulatory sequences and trans-acting regulatory sequences. Now, what do they mean by a regulatory sequence to begin with? If you look at your handout, you notice it says on the top, regulatory sequence, either cis-acting or trans. Now, what we mean by a regulatory sequence is some section where if you alter or delete it, the regulation of some gene goes berserk. So you have some gene like globin. There's some part of the DNA that has to be transcribed and spliced and so forth to make the RNA to make globin. But there are other regions that control how much globin, when you make globin, etc. And if you delete those regions, you make too much globin, not enough globin, globin at the wrong time, etc. So any region where you delete it and you change regulation is called a regulatory sequence. But there are two kinds, as drawn here, and one way to explain it is like this. So these are two different DNA molecules. And they have some genes in the middle that get transcribed and make proteins. Now, for this argument, these can be two homologous chromosomes with copies of the same thing, or they can be two different chromosomes, depending on the fine points. But we're assuming that we have two regulatory regions. I'm going to call the DNAs A and B. We have two regulatory regions, one and two. And both of these regulatory regions are found on both chromosomes. Now, what does this mean? If I mess up two, the expression of these genes is messed up. One or both of these genes is messed up. I make too much of the corresponding protein, not enough, etc. If I mess up gene one, same thing. I either get too much or too little. So both one and two are regulatory sequences, because when we mess them up, the expression of genes changes. But the difference is, if I mess up one, say, I only affect expression of the genes on A. If I mess up one on the other DNA, I only affect regulation of genes on B. So this is called a cis-acting site. It only affects genes on the same DNA. If I change it, I change the expression. If I change the one on A, I affect the expression of the genes on A. If I change the one on B, I change the expression of the genes on B. But nothing happens to the other genes. If I mess up one on B, the genes on A are still expressed normally. So one is said to be a cis-acting site. Now, suppose I mess up two on B, and I change the expression of both the genes on B and the genes on A. That's called a transacting site. So this is summarized in the second table where it says on your notes, where it explains that cis-acting affects only the DNA on which it occurs. Transacting acts every place there is a target for it. So now if we go back to our switch, what do trans and cis acting represent, molecularly speaking? The cis acting sequences must be the DNA to which a factor binds. And the transacting genes or regulatory elements code for factors, usually proteins, that can diffuse through the cell and land on their target wherever it is. So a cis-acting section is a target, and the transacting codes for a factor, usually a protein, that binds to the target. And then it either makes transcription better or worse. So what we're saying is, if we mess up B, then the corresponding protein could affect what happens at one. It could affect what happens at two. But if we mess up one, which is a target or DNA sequence, then that only affects binding to one. And that only affects what happens next door. It doesn't affect across the street. Now, What are transcription factors? Which category are they like? You can always cheat and look at your handout. But transcription factors, notice the word factor, are in fact transacting factors. They're proteins that can move through the cell, and any time they find their target DNA, they can sit on it. So a transacting factor, it says it right here. What's a eukaryote example of a transacting factor? It's a transcription factor. And we've said already there are two kinds, basal and regulatory. Now, what's a prokaryotic example? I left the box open. If we look back here, what is a cis-acting factor? So what I would like you to do is to think. We talked about regulation in prokaryotes last semester. It was a lot simpler. We talked about how you control transcription through operons. Now, if you think back to that, what goes in the boxes? What is a prokaryotic example of a transacting factor and a prokaryotic example of a cis-acting sequence? So I want you to think about that rather than raise your hand and discuss it, and then I'll call on you. Okay? So you get about 30 seconds to try and fill in those two boxes. Transacting one. What is a prokaryotic transacting factor? Now, the truth is, I think it tells you in the tables, but what is a suggestion? What is a protein made in a prokaryote that can go sit on a DNA sequence and turn a gene on or off? A repressor. So a repressor protein is the primary and obvious example. But what would be a cis-acting element? An operator, and there's one other one that you know about, a promoter. An operator or a promoter is a cis-acting sequence. The repressor sits on the operator, and the RNA polymerase sits on the promoter. But in both of those cases, you have one of these switches. You have a DNA sequence and a protein that sits on it. Now, we said when you have eukaryotes, it's always the same but worse. It's always more complicated. So in eukaryotes, you have promoters also. But the promoters are more complicated. They have multiple parts. So you notice over here where it talks about the cis-acting section, I've written on your handout that a prokaryotic example, as we've said, is an operator or a promoter. And for a eukaryote example, there's what's called the core promoter. But there are then additional control elements. And to understand what is meant by this, the easiest way is to look at the bottom of your handout where I have written a typical eukaryotic gene. So this represents the DNA, and of course the DNA is double-stranded. But for convenience, one always refers to the sense strand, which is always written 5 prime to 3 prime, and this is the sense strand. Now we know the other strand's there. It's just more convenient to write it this way. And you notice there's a bent arrow here. That usually corresponds to the start of transcription. And unless it says otherwise, that's what it means. It sometimes refers to the start of translation, but if so, it says so. Now, how do you keep track of what part you're talking about? The bases are generally numbered from here. The first one is plus one, etc. And let's say the 10th one would be plus 10, and so on. And this is called downstream. Because you read, you go in this direction. And when this is transcribed, then you put a ribosome on it. The ribosome goes this way. The RNA polymerase goes this way, etc. Now, on the other hand, the other direction is called upstream. And it's numbered minus 1, etc. And there's a little box here, which we'll explain in a minute, which is usually about minus 25. So that means you count back 25 bases. Now notice there is no zero base. There's just a line, and everything on one side of it is plus, everything on the other side is 1. This is like AD and BC, or BCE and CE, or like AM and PM. There is no zero. It's just everything after a certain point is 1, and before is the other. Okay. Now, the core promoter is the part of this where the transcription factors, the basal transcription factors, and RNA polymerase go. First the transcription factors, then RNA polymerase on top. So that's called the core promoter. Now, what is included in the core promoter varies a little bit from authority to authority and actual real case to real case. But it usually includes the start of transcription and a little bit around it. And a section here which extends somewhere up to minus 25. So this would be the core promoter. Now, it's defined by what can you delete that prevents basal transcription. If you don't need it for basal transcription, it's not part of the core promoter. Basal transcription is the small amount of transcription you get when you have only basal transcription factors and RNA polymerase. No regulatory. Not all core promoters are exactly the same, and some extend a little further into the transcribed section. But most of the core promoter is a little bit upstream of the start of transcription. Now, as we've said, basal transcription factors bind here, and RNA polymerase goes on top. What about regulatory transcription factors? Where do they go? Well, if you come back to here, instead of looking at it from the transcription factor part, if we look at it from the cis-acting sequences part, we said there's the core promoter, but there's additional control elements. These are where the regulatory transcription factors go. There are usually sequences somewhere around here, relatively close to the core promoter. And these are usually called proximal control elements. Usually anything that's up to, that's somewhere between minus 100 and minus 200 counts. Now, when people first discovered these things, they thought they had clear separate categories. We now know that the categories blend into each other. And so sometimes these things are so close to the core promoter that some people consider them part of the core promoter. It's a matter of taste and the individual case. In order to get any decent amount of transcription, you have to have regulatory transcription factors as well as the basal ones. This is largely tested in vitro. If you just add the basal transcription factors, you get a piddly amount of transcription. If you add the right transcription factors, you get a lot. Now, I realize there is something I forgot to say earlier. If you go back to this picture, It isn't totally clear here, but on the top of the handout, there is one extra table. And that's where it says type of control, positive and negative. And I realize we left that out, but we'll come back to that in a minute. Now, if you look at your picture, you notice that there's a dotted part here, and then there's more stuff written further up. These are also control elements. And these, since they're far away, are called distal control elements. Now, in this picture, the distal control elements are quite far away. They can be hundreds or thousands of base pairs away. I've drawn them here on the 5' end, but they can also be on the 3' end, and they can be in introns within the gene. They can be in many different places. Now, why do we call them control elements? If you delete any of these, you change transcription. If these are necessary for high transcription and you take them out, you get low transcription. If these are needed to turn transcription off, you take them away, you get... If these are needed to make it high, you take them away, you get low transcription. If these are needed to turn it off, then in their absence, you get too high a transcription. But the point is that all of these, if you change them or delete them, affect the level of transcription. Now, it is understandable how proximal control elements could work. You could put proteins on here that would interfere with or promote the binding of basal transcription factors, and so you would encourage or discourage transcription. That seems reasonable. But how could a sequence that is 1,000 base pairs away, or 2,000, or 5,000, or 10,000, have any effect whatsoever on transcription? Now, the answer to that is that the DNA isn't straight. We have drawn the DNA as if it is stretched out. But in fact, it's all folded over itself. And it's all tangled up. And the way the DNA really looks is probably more like this. Now, if that's right, here is our core promoter. I'll just write it here. It started transcription. Here's the core promoter. So you have basal transcription factors sitting here. Here are your proximal control elements. You have transcription factors sitting there. And you can understand how they might affect the neighbors. But now you have one of these distal ones. And when I draw the DNA this way, distal isn't so far away. The distal control element is actually quite close to the core promoter. So if we had some proteins sitting here, they could interact directly with the transcription factors and or RNA polymerase that is sitting on the core promoter. And this is thought what is to happen. Now, these sequences, these distal ones, are usually called either enhancers or silencers. An enhancer improves transcription. You take it away and transcription dies. A silencer turns off transcription. You take it away and transcription is too high. Now, one of the things that people discovered about enhancers and silencers, which was not true of core promoters and is usually not true of proximal elements, is that you can turn them around. If by genetic engineering you take out the double-stranded sequence here at the core promoter and you turn it around, what will happen? When RNA polymerase binds, it'll sit down this way instead of this way. So what will happen is instead of transcribing in that direction downstream, you will in fact transcribe this way. And you will use the other strand for template, you will make a different RNA, etc., etc. If you turn around an enhancer, usually nothing happens. It works just as well. Now, the explanation for that is that when you twist the DNA around like this, you could twist it the way I drew it, but you could also twist it this way, something like that. And so it doesn't matter which way this sequence was in. You can orient it properly, even if it was reversed. You can orient it properly relative to the core promoter by twisting the DNA around. Now, for most proximal elements, you can't turn them around. But remember we said that we now realize that some of these sequences, some of these control elements don't fall neatly into categories. And so some of the properties that are attributed to distal are sometimes found in proximal and vice versa. Now, there's one thing I forgot to say, but I want to see where I want to put it in. Okay. I think I have said most of what I wanted to say about these cis-acting sequences. That is the description of this DNA and how you number it and how you set it up. But now I want to consider the other half. In any switch, you have the DNA on which the factor sits and you have the factor that sits on it, the transacting factor. So these are cis-acting factors, the core promoter, the proximal control elements, and the distal control elements. What about the proteins that come and sit on them, the transcription factors and regulators? How do they work? So that's what I want to talk about next. But first, let me ask, are there questions about the cis half? Yeah.
Since there's one core promoter and many distal control elements, do they constantly move and realign?
So if you have multiple enhancers, say, or distal elements, her question is, do they constantly realign? I think in any one cell at any one time, one of them, one enhancer region or silencer, is opposite the core promoter. But now if the cell switches gears and turns on other genes and off other genes, then this situation may readjust. Yeah? How can you turn around distal elements? They are not palindromes. And first of all, remember, we're talking genetic engineering, not cells. But what we're saying is, if this is a DNA sequence, and I just write it like this. So what we're saying is, and then the core is down here. Now in this one, if I just loop it over, my distal element is pointing this way. But in this one, if I just loop it over, the distal will be pointing the wrong way. But if I loop it the way I did here, where this is the core, if I loop the DNA around, this sequence, even though it was pointing in a reverse direction in the original, is now in the right orientation relative to the core promoter that it is supposed to be. Okay, so let's look at the other half, the proteins that are sitting on these control elements. Now, what about the, let's do the basal first, and then we'll do the regulatory. Now, remember, there are three different polymerases. Each polymerase has a collection of transcription factors that go with it. The ones that go with RNA polymerase 2, which is the primary polymerase we're interested in because it makes mRNA, the transcription factors for it are called TF2A, TF2B, etc. This is transcription factor for polymerase 2A. And last time I checked, they were up to H or F or G or something. There are quite a lot of them. The most famous one is called TF2D. This is a very important transcription factor, which itself has many subunits. And one of them is called TBP. BP is binding protein. But the T is for TATA because in many, but not all core promoters, there is a short sequence of T's and A's. And a short sequence is often called a box. So this is called the TATA box. And it turns out that that's the TATA binding protein. So a piece of the big TF2D is what sticks here, and that seems to be critical in the binding of RNA polymerase. So if you take molecular biology, or you read the textbooks, you can learn more about all the transcription factors and who binds first and who's needed for what and what their structure is. But we're just going to leave that and talk about the regulatory ones. Now, the basal transcription factors are thought to be the same in every cell all the time. Every cell has the same ones, and they pretty much, every gene uses the same collection. But the regulatory transcription factors are different from cell type to cell type. And they, remember, are what's critical in determining which sections of the chromatin will be open and which genes will be read, transcribed, and expressed. So where do they bind? The regulatory transcription factors generally bind either to the proximal control elements or the distal control elements. And just as these control elements can either turn up or turn down transcription, so can transcription factors. We have been talking about transcription factors as if they were all helpers of transcription. But in fact, some of them increase transcription and some of them decrease it. And generally, they're given different names depending on what they do. So you can have a transcription factor, and I think this is written on your... It isn't... it is. So on the top of the handout of 10A, where it has regulatory transcription factors, you notice it says they can be activators or they can be repressors. That is, they can turn transcription off or down, or they can increase transcription or turn it on. Now, when we talked about prokaryotes, to come back to operons for a minute, we said that you have a repressor protein that turns things off. And when it's not around, you get uncontrolled constitutive production of the enzymes involved. Now, that is called negative control. And the top panel, actually, summarizes the difference for what is called positive and negative control. In negative control, you have a protein that turns things off. And when you take it away, transcription starts. Positive control is exactly the opposite. Nothing happens until a protein binds. And then that protein turns things on. So in prokaryotes, it is thought that you have mostly negative control. If you leave it alone, it's on. If you add the protein, it's off. And the rationale for this is that in bacteria, you need most of the genes most of the time. So unless you do something, they're on. You have to actively turn them off. With eukaryotes, it's the reverse. Most of your genes are off most of the time. Because think about it. Each of your cells has the same DNA. That DNA is enough to run a liver, a kidney, a brain, skin, the whole works. But in skin, what proportion of those genes are actually on? Some very small percentage. So each cell type is only using a few genes at a time. A few percent of its total genes at a time. And as a result, it makes sense that in eukaryotes, positive control, keep it off until I do something, appears to be very important. So that activators that come along and turn things on appear to be a very big deal. Now, you have both activators and repressors in both systems, but eukaryotes seem to depend more on positive control and prokaryotes on negative. So most of the cases we've talked about here involve enhancers and activators of transcription, although the reverse exists as well. Now, how does one of these proteins activate transcription? There are several possibilities, but there are two that we mentioned here. One is a kind of direct interaction here, where one protein binds to the DNA on one side, and it binds to another protein on the other side. And a protein that does this is usually called a transcription factor. It actually binds to the DNA, and then on the other side, it binds to a protein. On the other hand, there are proteins that are middlemen, so that you have something like this. Now, you notice this protein is not binding to the DNA at all. This protein is binding to two other proteins and acting as a middleman. And those kinds of proteins are usually not called transcription factors, although sometimes they are. They're usually called co-activators or co-repressors. Or you could call them assistants to transcription factors. Now, what are they doing? One possibility is they're just helping glue the whole thing together. They're just acting to stabilize the whole complex. They're acting as mediators. And there is one protein complex, in fact, that's called mediator. Another possibility, though, is that one of these intermediate proteins that only sticks to DNA is actually a modification enzyme. That once it sticks to the complex, it then modifies histones, say, which then changes the state of transcription. So they can also be modification enzymes. Now, there's one piece of this we have to add. In both prokaryotes and eukaryotes, you have what is called coordinate control. When you turn on one gene, you turn on other genes that are also required at the same time to get something done. It doesn't help to turn on one gene in a pathway if you need five genes to carry out the pathway. Now, in prokaryotes, that's achieved by having operons. So the genes are all clustered together, and they have one promoter and one operator, so you turn the whole thing on or the whole thing off. But in eukaryotes, it's generally not like that. Generally, in eukaryotes, the genes say for five different proteins that you need to get something done. Those five proteins will be encoded by genes on five different chromosomes. So you have five chromosomes. Well, I'm going to write it this way. And you need to transcribe all of them to make the four or five proteins to carry out a pathway to get something done. How can you ensure that when you turn on one, you turn on all of them? The trick is they have the same cis-acting elements. So if you make the right transcription factor, it will sit on all of them. And it will turn them all on at once. And if you make the right repressor type transcription factor, it will turn them all off. Now, the only thing wrong with this picture is it's one for one. We know that any real gene has many different control elements, and that so some transcription factor sits here, some transcription factor sits here, and some transcription factor sits here. So exactly what combination is made in that cell is going to determine whether this is turned on. And they may share one and not share another. So under one set of conditions, you make a transcription factor and it turns them all on. Under another set of conditions, you make a different transcription factor and it turns this one on, but not the others. So the situation is combinatorial. Now, what is different between, say, your brain and your liver? Is it the cis-acting sequences or the trans-acting factors? Why don't you think about that? We'll talk about it next time.